This meeting is now being recorded.
All right, welcome all to the December 4th meeting for the Budget Advisory Committee. We all know each other. I would like to tell myself this is a public meeting, obviously, and we have interested college speakers. I'm the chair of this committee, and I do welcome every member to this room. We're going to take roll call in just a minute for this and I'll review. I think we have every member present, except for a few who were having some traffic problems this morning, opted to call in, but that's only two or three of us. So with that, I'm going to turn immediately to Brandy and ask her to take roll call and go over a few housekeeping items.
Ms. Compton?
Present.
Ms. Barton?
Here.
Ms. Blum?
Here.
Ms. Buckley?
Here.
Ms. Coe? Is Judge Cope?
So Judge Cope informed me that today is also coincides with the first day of the installation of their case management system. So he said he would do his best to stay by the phone, but I think we all understand that that's going to take some effort, so that's where he is.
Judge Herman?
Here.
Judge Heinrich?
Here.
Judge Johnson? Judge Lucas?
Here.
Judge Marginis?
Here.
Judge Maragonda?
Here.
Judge McCabe?
Here by phone.
Thank you. Ms. Carter?
Here.
Ms. Eberhardt?
Here.
Mr. Finke?
Here.
Ms. Fleming?
Here.
Ms. Leonard?
Here.
Mr. Harrigan? Mr. Lewis?
Here.
Mr. Planet?
Here. Here.
Ms. Romero-Cole?
Here by phone.
Mr. Taylor?
Here.
And Capo Bianco?
Here.
And Mr. Yamataki? Can we try one more time for Judge
Cope? Right. So is there anybody, any member that's called in on the phone who has not had an ability to register their attendance? All right, thank you.
A reminder that this meeting is open to the public and is being recorded for members on the phone. The person who is prior to speaking for the benefit of all. For members on the phone as well, please place your phones on mute when not speaking, and please do not click your cell phone.
All right. With that, I'm going to move to a motion to approve the minutes. The minutes are in your agenda. We have minutes from the June 8th, June 29th, and October 12th PITFAC meetings that are depicted on pages, beginning on pages 4, 8, and 9 of your materials. These materials were distributed timely. I hope you've had an opportunity to review them. And with that, I would welcome a motion, and I'll just consider it a motion to approve all three. Unless anybody has a concern about any particular date, we would like to discuss it separately. But otherwise, I'll entertain a motion of approval by my planet for the minutes of the 8th and the 29th of June and the 12th of October. Second, any opposition? Well, I'll just ask. I'm all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Oh, I'm sorry.
I prefer to abstain.
Okay, I understand that. So Judge Lucas has noted that since she was not a member at that point, she's abstaining. So is Ms. Eberhardt. So is everybody else who's raising their hand. Judge Buckley, Judge Martinez, thank you. And members of Mr. Finke as well. So those are, that's understandable. Those were members who were not present at the time, but were well within the necessary members for a quorum, even giving those abstentions. So all the motions approved unanimously, except for abstentions as noted. We next move to public comment. As you all are aware, there are two methods of public comment, both written and in person, and I'll address in person first out of respect for anybody that was in the room to make an in-person comment, and I don't believe anybody signed up for in-person public comment this morning. I want to make sure I'm not leaving anything out. I've looked around. I see no anxious hands, so there's no in-person public comment. We all received, I believe, separately a written public comment from the County of Alameda. That first was distributed individually to I believe, every committee member, and then in an abundance of caution, had to make sure that that written material was included in what you actually have in your hands today. So in case you didn't get a separate communication from that court earlier, you have it in your materials. I believe that was the only written public comment submitted, and therefore that is in your materials for your consideration. That includes public comment of the meeting. So after 9 minutes, we've accomplished quite a bit of business already. So we're now going to turn to the three action items on our agenda. As with any meeting, folks, this meeting could be well within the time period that we've allotted or to the maximum time period we've allotted, and I would welcome both. The purpose of this meeting, as we discuss each of these separate issues, is to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to question, comment, and state any concerns about what will ultimately be requested to be a report to be approved to move on to the Judicial Council. So this will come in three parts today, overgeneralizing where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. Where we've been, that is WAFM for the first 5 years, and Leah will address that, where we are today. And that is, just as a preview, what I think has been the substantial work of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee that's led to the recommendations you have before you today, and then finally where we're going, and that is the continuing work plan. So I know you've all made long trips. We have plenty of time to discuss this, and that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to turn first for the first item of the historical review of WAFM and turn to Leah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And this is also included in the packet that was sent to members ahead of time. So I'm not going to, I'm going to give a what I would refer to flyover synopsis of the report that was included. The historical report summarizes the first 5 years of WAFM implementation and was put together to help the Funding Methodology Subcommittee determine whether WAFM method goals set when the model was first published. So this report, again, tracks with the presentation that was given at the August 8th and 9th Funding Methodology Subcommittee meeting, but there was a request to put the contents of that presentation in written format. The report includes a synopsis of the five-year implementation plan and details the new funding that was allocated to the branch when applicable. Also summarizes the WAFM methodology as it was adopted in 2016, and it lists out the subsequent modifications to the methodology to account for any new or emerging policy issues. The report then goes on to summarize various measures of funding equity and whether WAFM has achieved its primary goal of increasing funding equity. And the analysis shows that funding variability over time become more equal. This is probably best illustrated in the maps that compare funding ratios by court before WAFM was implemented and after 5 years. And I have that map here on the screen to show members. The courts are grouped into categories corresponding to colors. The dark red is for courts in the 50-60% underfunded range, while the dark green shows the courts that are 0 to 10% underfunded. The dark green category also includes any court that is over 100% of funding needs, as well as courts that have more funding, which would likewise be courts that did receive floor funding are marked with a gray triangle. I try to see them on the northern and eastern parts of the state. So what this graph, or what these two maps would show, is that on the left, before WAFM was put into place, there was, as you can see, a great disparity in the colors, showing that the courts were funded at very different levels. But then after 5 years of WAFM implementation, the map on the right shows that the funding disparity has decreased and that the colors are more uniformly applied, mostly yellows. Also in the historical report is a series of line graphs in the appendix that shows each court's funding ratios, which means their funding allocation over their funding need. And just a note about the groupings of courts, because I had some questions about that after we gave the report at FMS. The groupings of courts, the courts are grouped into a series of five or so different graphics, and it's, you know, it's merely a matter of too unwieldy to show all 58 courts on one graph because of the scale issue. So the courts are grouped by similarly sized funding allocation at baseline. and those graphs likewise show that funding ratios have generally increased over time, both in part due to new investment in the branch, as well as declines in filings that have lowered funding. Overall, the analysis shown in the historic report suggests that Waltham has helped make the branch make progress on funding equity, although it does note that it has not completely resolved the equity issues. And that was the conclusion of what I was going to present, Judge Kunkel, and I'll leave it open to any questions.
Okay, I'm moving along quickly, obviously. So I think everybody in the room, either through experience or through participating in this committee, has an idea of where we were. There are and continue to be, obviously, the competing issues of equity versus funding and how that is appropriately addressed and distributed. So this map is not new, I don't think, to any of you. This map has been displayed to this committee, to committees throughout the state, and the purpose of the map, from my perspective, and again, this is a discussion, I'm one of those discussing as the chair. My only role is to make sure everybody has that opportunity, but my opinion is no more important than anybody else's. But I was struck by the fact that one of the first times this was introduced, Judge Earl was in the room, who is, I think we all recognize the individual, along with others, Latko and others, who developed this originally. And my understanding, not being in the room at the time, was this was the purpose. This was the hope that after Waltham was looked at after 5 years, there would be a movement to address those courts. And I know the terms donor and recipient are hot-button issues. We're doing our best to stay away from those. We sort of moved to those courts that are involuntarily generous and those courts that are involuntarily needful. Perhaps not as easy to say, but I think gets the point across a little bit better. But I think what this map helps us understand is, while that pain continues to be real, wherever you are on the spectrum, that we're hoping that it is also one that is dulled, if that's the right way to put it, a little bit, by the fact that everybody is hopefully receiving some assistance, though obviously to the detriment of others. So we had quite a bit of time allotted for this discussion or to build in any questions or concerns about the past 5 years. And did Waltham do what we wanted it to do? So that's what I will open this up to before we get into hopefully going where Waltham will be getting us where we want. Any thoughts, concerns? Okay. For those listening on the phone, as I would say in the courtroom, for the reporter, I paused, I've waited, I see no hands. So I paused, I've waited, I see no hands. And with that, at this point, we move on to item number two. Is there a need to approve? All right. Item number one? Yeah. All right. So, again, you have that in your materials. The recommendation itself is set forth at page 23. So the recommendation is, no, I'm sorry, I'm looking at item two. I apologize. I was reading ahead. Pardon me. Right. So the request would be a motion to adopt the report to go to the council concerning the historical review of Waltham-based allocations. That report has set forth on pages 10 through 21 of your materials.
I'll move.
Okay. Motion and numerous seconds in the room that are being recorded by staff. Thank you. The motion to move and approve the report to the Judicial Council on behalf of TICFAC has been moved and seconded. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Hearing none. And I don't believe anybody needs to abstain. I can't tell you. If you want to abstain, you can. But the fact that you are a new member in the room, I don't think prevents you from voting on this from an abstention perspective. And I see no abstentions. Moved and approved. Thank you. Okay. So that now takes us to item number two, which is where we are today and how we hope to how we have developed and hope to, at the conclusion of this meeting, approve a funding methodology to present to the council in January. This methodology comes to us thanks to the work of Funding Methodology Subcommittee. I think every member of that committee is in the room, save Judge Cope, who's now joined us on the phone. There may be one or two others on the phone, but that Funding Methodology Subcommittee has met, I believe, 8 times? And most of those in person from June 2017, sort of the pinnacle of those meetings was a two-day meeting that occurred in Sacramento, kept us sort of locked in the room for many hours each day. It was a challenging and, at the end of the day, productive discussion. I share that with Ms. Fleming, who's sitting to my right, and so her voice is also important to listen to today, probably much more than mine, given her working knowledge of these issues, as well as everybody else in the room that was on the Funding Methodology Subcommittee. I think you all enjoyed by saying that, I think that I don't appreciate the work of this committee as a whole, but I must say the members of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee worked diligently to produce this product for you. In producing this product, we welcomed considerations and recommendations from other entities and courts. We did our best to consider those. I think we accomplished that task, though obviously there may be other views on that. There were challenges that were presented from the perspective of, and sort of using the map as an example, it is difficult, if not impractical, to say to everybody, you're going to get everything you want. That's how WAPM was developed. Recognition of compromise and in recognition of some courts would not see the same growth that others did. But we also recognize that in the first 5 years of WAPM, there was some unanticipated movement or involuntarily, those courts that were involuntarily generous, I think, had unexpected movement within their budgets. And so as we came in the room with FMS to develop a methodology, our goal was one of transparency, predictability, and ultimately maybe flexibility at the end of the day, but one to allow courts to anticipate perhaps as best possible their budget needs, their the funding methodology that would be used to determine the distribution of funds to them, and whether or not they should and could anticipate any reduction from that need. And we did our best to work within the concerns of the courts saying, hey, you have to give us some ability to plan. And candidly, for those courts that were involuntarily generous for years, like those courts that were involuntarily needful, you have to consider the pain we've suffered. Even though we're viewed as having more funding than those courts, that doesn't mean we don't feel pain. So I welcome comments from any other funding methodology subcommittee member in the room as we work through these recommendations, but that's what our task was, and that's what the lens was through which we viewed the ultimate product that you have before you. So, Rebecca, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I would just echo that. For those who are not on the Funding Methodology Subcommittee, this group worked very hard, right? It was a very long process, and we kept it very slow and somewhat tedious for a reason. And I think that there wasn't a question that we didn't fully flush out, and there was still, as in the first iteration of WAPM, a high level of compromise and consideration for courts other than the ones that we were perhaps originating from that morning. And so, you know, again, though, you know, for those who are not on the Funding Methodology Subcommittee, ask your questions today, because we really, I think I speak for the committee in that we feel good about the product that's going forward, and we feel like we have fleshed out quite a few of the questions. So if there are remaining questions, please ask them today so that we don't have anything that kind of comes up later that we could have resolved today for somebody.
So you'll see in the report at pages 22 and 23, and the way, for those of you that weren't in the room, this was a very sophisticated process. We used a whiteboard, and Rebecca, thanks to her ability to write legibly versus mine, that you couldn't read the same. save your life. We filled it. We filled whiteboards around the room for days and took pictures of them to make sure that we were we stayed, one, on track, and two, we stayed true to where we said we were going. Some of the objectives, some of the, as you can see, objectives, principles, and measures changed as we went. We flipped some around. We eliminated some. But at the end of the day, here's what we came up with. So using those objectives, principles, and measures, we then came up with, turning now to page 24 of your materials, as it's set out, and this is all part of the report that ultimately we're going to suggest by unanimous vote from FMS that be approved by this committee for presentation to the Judicial Council. So the first was determining need. We had different proposals. We had a proposal that was more population-based. That proposal, as is documented, was withdrawn. Before being withdrawn, was considered, was vetted by staff. I'm aware of that because some of that vetting occurred well after hours through phone calls between staff, between me and Rebecca, to make sure. And then that request for suggestion was withdrawn with, a tone of looking towards workload-based allocations and concerns about perhaps how that workload was measured. And we did our best to stay and address those concerns. So one of the first steps we took and that was recommended was reaffirm the workload model using the resource assessment study as a basis for establishing funding needs. So let's use that as a starting point. That's where the committee started its work to determine the need of the trial courts, their budget. Comments, concerns about that workload method and the resource assessment study and the mechanics of it. Concerns? Okay, everybody's had their coffee, right? Materials, I hope this is a reflection of the materials themselves and the clarity of those materials. But again, in the first section of determining need, is there anything you wanted to add about the need determination itself? Okay.
Yeah, this is David. Having actually attended some of the sessions, I think it to synthesize it in sentences, just a few sentences, kind of underestimates the amount of work that the FMS put into this. And I know that there are a lot of new members here today. And it might be helpful just to kind of go over some of the rationale behind all that, just so there's a clear understanding of the importance of the components, because I fully support, you know, certainly on this particular item, the rationale behind it, and there was not a lot of opposition, but for the benefit of others, I don't know if it would be helpful to just kind of touch upon them just very briefly, and why things were maintained in the fashion that they have. And I think we have a little bit of time.
Sure, I think we have, so far at least, plenty of time. As you were talking, I'll lay open up her laptop again, so as far as rationale, is that where you were going back to review notes on? So she's going to look for a note. So I'll start it off by, again, oversimplifying. The workload we determined was the best measurement available to us to determine the money, the funding that was needed for our courts to run business, to run their courts efficiently. Does that mean to run them as to a premium, or does that mean to run as best as possible? In one sense, yes, and in another sense, that's impossible because – as you'll see as we work through these materials, we are to the point where we are focusing in a funding level that all of us agree does not meet 100% of our needs. So if the funding level does not address 100% of our needs, then it is by that measurement we cannot address all of our needs. So that then caused us to say where is that sweet spot, where we can be reasonable about the money we are obtaining and how we best utilize that, and what's the best measurement of that. And that was workload. And now Leah has her laptop open and can review that for us in more detail.
Now I can speak. So workload is the weighted caseload model.
all the resources and models that we utilize is a what's called a weighted caseload model, and it is the same model that we see 30 other states employing to assess workload needs. And weighted caseload achievement.
Leah, can you get a microphone closer to you? I've got it all the way up and can still barely hear you.
Oh, sure. Is that any better?
Yes, thank you.
Allows us to measure changes in workload need over time because we use a three-year running average of filings data to update RAS. And it also lets us differentiate between cases of different types. So all of us, all the courts have different mixes or blends of cases. And we had seen in, if we were to compare two courts that may have very similar population profiles, we could see very different makeups of filings just depending on demographics and other factors in the jurisdiction. The DA's charging practices, that's another contributor to our differentiating workload needs. So weighted caseload allows us to identify those differences and measure towards them so that we can assess the appropriate number of resources for each of those courts. We update the workload models approximately every 5 years, and in doing so, it allows us to make sure that our models reflect the most recent changes to the law, technology, and case processing practices. So Prop 47 is an example of a major change in our criminal workload case processing, and our most recent update of the resource assessment study model, which was just approved by the council in July of 2017, accounts for the different changes and practices resulting from Prop 47. So it was on that basis that the committee decided to continue with using RAS to serve as the foundation for WASA.
Any questions on that? And I hope, Judge McCain, could you hear that once Leah stood up, could you hear better?
I did. Thank you very much.
All right, great. So I think it was a great summary. Mr. Pinky?
So, thank you. This is Chad Pinky from Alameda. So the one comment I guess I would just make, as you noted, Judge Conklin, we had put forth the population model. We withdrew it and sort of recognizing that the strong sentiment was to go in favor of a workload model and there's a lot of precedent for that. I would just reiterate the concern that, just for the record, that we've said many times, which is, if the model is going to be based on workload as represented by filings, we would hope that before, I understand the current proposal is for 18-19 to be a hold harmless year regardless. So if this model, where then subsequent flat years potentially result in cuts, if that's what's adopted, we would just strongly urge that the council try to do some sort of a filings audit between now and then. It has certainly come up at the SEAC GIPSIS working group that I'm on, that there are some inconsistencies in how courts report. It has come up at SEAC meetings generally. I'm told it's come up at TCPJAC meetings. So if the filings are going to be the basis for potential reductions, we would hope that the council could somehow dedicate staff. I realize Grant and his team are kind of starting out, but we would hope for a full, 58-court audit just to make sure that we're all reporting apples to apples. So that's my sort of take on the workload piece.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Any comments or concerns about that? I understand that concern. That concern has been voiced. You're right. Part of that is outside of TICBAC and FMS. It's sort of the measurement that comes to us. I think, candidly, there may have been two perspectives, the one of a misunderstanding and the one of courts fudging the numbers. I don't know how else to put it. I think the better way is a misunderstanding of the calculation versus a fudging of the calculation. I have not received nor seen anything that would cause a concern that courts are in any way intentionally not accurately reporting the numbers, but as with everything else, there's some subjectivity to that measurement, and therefore I think that concern has been presented and is being addressed by those committees that are the appropriate ones to address it.
Yeah, and if I could just, stop on this, but I certainly am not meaning to suggest anybody's fudging. The analogy I always use is if the GIPSIS may be a chef. He thinks of tomatoes as a vegetable. He doesn't report them. Brian's a botanist. He's like, oh, that's true. He reports them, right? It's that kind of a thing where the definitions themselves, in some instances, are not really clear. And I think in complete good faith, we may have courts just interpreting them in different ways.
All right. Mike? So along with Mike Roddy is one of the two people that's been involved with this GIPSIS work group since almost the beginning. Just to be clear, our intent going into this was to address the issue of different interpretations of definitions, and to that extent, in that context, then to correct them, make them more understandable, get a group of courts that are active in GIPSIS, you know, and we had some great experts from some courts there, and we were able to flesh out the question. So the intent was to come up with a set of definitions that everybody understood so that we would all be operating by this, under the same definitions, and also give some direction to our case management system vendors on how to do that. One of the other issues is that some of the courts report through GIPSIS, some of the courts report through what's called the portal. And so there's different levels of technological capability when it comes to doing the statistics, and that's going to remain an ongoing issue, I think, until we get all these courts onto the new systems. But certainly the intent was to come up with a set of was to fill in gaps, make things less ambiguous, and so everybody could be marching from the off the same page.
All right. Any other thoughts on that? I'm doing a lot of talking on this determining need, I guess because I'm the chair of TechBack and I'm the one supposed to talk, but I would invite any funding methodology subcommittee members in the room. This was a spirited discussion with a lot of excellent perspectives on rationale shared. So if anybody has any other rationale or thought they'd like to voice, my thought is we'll go through these as by letter, A, B. Right, we're going to go through on A, we're going to go through 1 through 6 and just discuss them, but then I'll invite a motion to approve A as a whole unless anybody wants to break out separately. So we reaffirm the workload model. We have the report a workload need adjustment every fiscal year based on a three-year average. It'll be a rolling average. So every year, the workload need adjustment will be new, but it'll be a three-year average. So and the average, that's what happens. You look for the past 3 years, and the next year is the new year of that workload, and that will change. It's not an equity issue. It's not a reallocation issue based upon equity. It's simply workload. So that's how that will be determined. I think we just addressed that. The state element number 3 of determining need was a new statewide average funding ratio based upon workload, need adjustments, and new funding if applicable. One of the things we did decide to do is in item number 4 was to defer the impact of civil assessments until defer it on the model of 18-19. So civil assessments, and if anybody has any questions in the room that just has not drilled down on civil assessments, obviously those are their own, comes with their own set of issues in their own country, if not universe, of civil assessments and how they impact all of us. And it, to say there's 58 different trial courts states the obvious that there might also be 58 different impacts of civil assessments, how they're calculated, how they're distributed, the whole gamut. So we were certainly not trying in any way to ignore civil assessments. I think just the opposite. I think my perspective of the discussion in the room was there was a detailed understanding of the complications of civil assessments, but given that, and at this point, the inability to obtain the necessary information from those individual courts as to how the civil assessment was impacted, we felt, and if any member disagrees, please speak up, but we felt it would be not only detrimental, but perhaps least unproductive, if not detrimental, to throw civil assessments into the mix because we don't have enough information yet. So that's the rationale, Judge Heinrichs.
So there was a lot of discussion about how critically important civil assessments are and that if there's a change in how things happen, it has a major impact on courts and their budgets, but that our committee couldn't address it. So it wasn't because it wasn't important, and we certainly hope that someone is, as we know they are, addressing it in detail. It's just we couldn't build it into a model because we don't have enough information, and I think it's more of a, we talked about it a lot.
Sure did, Rebecca.
And I would just add, as we're going through these, one of the
the sheet that you might want to reference is on page 96, 3B, is the work plan going forward. So where we have some of these recommendations, such as the civil assessments, to roll it over to have discussion, at the end of our day today, you're going to be asked to also approve the work plan going forward, because there's a couple of things specifically that relate to some of these items that went to the work plan for further discussion. And so just so you can kind of look at those.
Any other thoughts on civil assessments in particular as they apply to determining need? Okay, let's see. Then we also had retain all existing small court adjustments, and that also went hand in hand somewhat with BLS. There was obviously a significant discussion about BLS as well, and we felt that the – and Judge Heinrichs.
I have one more thing to say. It's simply, I think it's important we realize that if there was adequate funding for our court, we would not be as feeling so much pain in regards to the matter. And that I, for those on the committee, the subcommittee know that I spoke a lot about BLS, and I do believe that our action plan going forward addresses it. There are some how it impacts Cluster 2 courts, how the small court adjustments impact some but not all Cluster 2 courts is a knot that we weren't able to untangle. And so as a result of that, I do believe that leaving it as it is now going forward is important. But I think the action plan we put in place is critical too, and that I think that we'll get some answers that will help address those courts that are impacted differently with the WAFO plan in an intelligent way. And just having a quick fix of doing something, especially without having adequate funding, wasn't a fair thing either for other courts. I just, so the summary that I have is not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and that we spent a lot of time talking about it. I was animated in some of the discussions that I had, but I do think that the work we've done and the fact that we're going to commit to doing it in the future is a really good step, and I think it was what we needed to do this year with all the other factors we had to consider.
And I appreciate the analogy of the of BLS and others being a knot. I would perhaps analogize to a multifaceted diamond, maybe, or something else. But BLS, it was – so somebody coming into the room that barely could understand what BLS, what it stood for. At the end of the day, I think we all developed a thorough understanding and the recognition that there are numerous facets to it, one of which was that it's a recognized measurement. I mean, we didn't make this up. BLS, we didn't just say, well, let's just – that was something that's been utilized in industries. And so one of the discussions we had was, if we start to tinker with BLS, where did it end? Once we open up that door, it's a recognized standard. There's no criticism that BLS itself, at least from my perspective, that BLS is something that is improperly measured or that BLS is defective. It's just – how is it impacted based upon the certain circumstances of all of our counties? And so the discussion at the end of the day was, well, we have to be careful, because if we open up the BLS door, are we saying that we think BLS itself is incorrect? And not really. So then we move forward. Sherry can probably say better than I do.
No, I was just going to say that it was really my motion to consider Cluster 2, and I'm glad on page 96 it clarifies it's more than just BLS. I think we need to look at Cluster 2 and a variety of things in place, because I really would be opposed to messing with a BLS factor that's done by, I think it's, who does it, the federal agency? So, you know, we shouldn't, but it's the combination of things and how they impact Cluster 2. So it's one piece of it. It's not that we're looking at BLS in Cluster 2. We're looking at Cluster 2. To see how the various issues impact, just like we did with Cluster 1s at one point. So it's really broader than that, which is I want to make sure everybody understood that.
And I think that was the point, following up on what Sherry is saying, that we looked at a number of factors that were impacting the Cluster 2 courts, and I think there were about six of them as we went through, and we spent a lot of time discussing the BLS factors, but as we we discussed with civil assessments, the committee, subcommittee decided that we can put this aside and work on this, but continue to move forward. And because you can have anywhere from a 4-judge court to a 15-judge court may fall under cluster 2 through different places, regions within the state. But I thought that the way that the subcommittee dealt with this issue moving forward to get to an ultimate proposal for the entire TICFAC was really well done, and there are many more pieces to this just besides BLS.
Thank you. Other thoughts on BLS or any of the first six under determining need? I think, as I said, what we'll do is I'll invite a motion with each letter block, so to speak, and I think we've worked through the six factors under determining need.
Well, I'll move that we approve.
Yes, for comments first.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Apologize.
Speaking from an impoverished cluster 2 county, which is 4 judges, BLS really guts us, makes it impossible for us to compete with the rich counties that are joining us. We've lost 30% of our staff to Sonoma County because they're allowed to pay more. I know we can pay what we want, but then we can't have as many employees, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm glad it's in this page 96 ongoing concern. I'm just wondering exactly what is it, evaluate cluster 2. What is, I'm not on the subcommittee, so I don't know what that means. What is to be evaluated?
Terry?
So all of the different adjustments that are made for the cluster 1 may or may not have different impacts on cluster 2, and it might be that those courts that are closer to the cluster 1, like the 4-judge court, might need some different reviews for some of those issues that we looked at for the cluster 1. So that's why the review is broader than just BLS. So, you know, I think, and I'm repeating myself for the people that were at the planning methodology meeting, so I apologize in advance, but I think we did ourselves somewhat of a disservice in how we portrayed the spreadsheets with the funding allocation under WAFM, because it presented BLS as if it was a takeaway. And it's really not a takeaway, because if you step back and come up to the 20,000-foot level, right, and you're looking at what we're trying to do, we measure our work. We know how many minutes on average things take. We apply it to an average salary. And what BLS does is it then says, based on your local market, where should you be compared to that local, to that average salary in California? And so, unfortunately, the column, like money was taken, when in fact the money was never there, even under the historical model. It was just a way to say, we're applying the average salary to your FTEs based on your workload, and this is how it should be adjusted. So I think it makes it feel like that money was taken, when in fact, even under the historical funding method, there really wasn't any, it doesn't change where the level of funding that's required for that county. So it's one piece of probably seven that we were going to look at for cluster 2 to see whether or not cluster 2 makes sense, because to go from 4 to 15, it might be that we need to say, well, these 4 are closer to 1, and maybe these 15 are closer to 3, and, you know, so we need to do a deep dive to kind of see how they all mesh together.
Rebecca.
And to tag on to that, the deeper dive piece that Sherry's talking about, that concern that you just shared with us, that was actually a concern that was shared from Lake County as well. And on the...
That is my count.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, I'm Rebecca.
We're
with you, brother.
Right.
And so when we worked with Krista on that initial, and Leah can probably articulate this better, but that particular piece of it alone, we couldn't show to be the tipping point for BLS. So the deeper dive was necessary because there's clearly some inconsistencies going on. But Linda, do you want to speak to that a little bit more? You're much better technically than me, but
sure. We've received a couple of different pieces of correspondence from Krista, and I think you might have been a co-signator on some of them. And so I presented the request was you know, that we look into the possibility of a regional BLS. And I
I presented some of those findings at the group, and we had some discussions about regional and where exactly can we draw the boundaries for a regional approach. So that was definitely part of the discussion. And we also, I know at one point you turned the discussion over to others in the room to ask about there were more instances of turnover that we could draw on. And I think in the time that we had given, we determined that we couldn't, the committee couldn't wrap its arms around what, you know, a establishing region or finding instances of other counties that shared the same principle and then moved on to some other.
Which is a polite way of saying for every problem we solved, we created another one.
Right.
Which is, that's what happened. As we and there was. This took up, understandably, a substantial period of time, but every time we said, oh, we got a fix, somebody else said, but by that fix, look what you create over here. So, Amana, again, and any FMS member who else wants to speak, I would invite that, but I really want to be careful to avoid the perception that we said, well, it's too hard, we're not going to talk about it. It was anything but that. It was, it's very hard, we need to talk about it. And at the end of the day, we felt that this solution, while not, and I think as the judge said, perfect and enemy of the good, while not being perfect, was the good, was best addressed and continued to address those concerns. Though obviously, I'm in Fresno, so I'm not a four-judge court, but we have within our own county, we have the same economies of scale that in different areas. Think about Los Angeles, who has, you know, standing in another branch, might have four judges in that building over in West Covina or something that's much different than Westwood. So we spent a lot of time here. Judge Heinrichs?
The only thing I want to say is when we do that deep dive, courts that are impacted, so Lake, others, if there's other things that you want us to look at or other information you want us to have, that I think the committee, the subcommittee, really invested in looking at all of those things and how they impact. Because, but what it came to, and, you know, there was a lot of sticking points along the way, but what it came to was exactly that. Once you, especially with a closed system, where if we give Lake more money, then somebody else loses money. It becomes this. It becomes us having that circular firing squad where we shoot each other, and that to try to get a method where we can all go forward and all kind of embrace that more money comes into the system, how everybody will benefit, and then how we can grow the lower courts. So it really is, I see my husband spent a lot of time, but an investment in making whatever concerns the Cluster 2 courts have, because the truth is how BLS or how WAFM impacts the smallest Cluster 2 courts is different than the larger Cluster 2 courts. And so it is, I don't want to commit now without fully investigating, and I think that with the work we could do, we could get a very good product that will address some of those issues, but we couldn't address them without pulling a thread, that as soon as you pulled the thread, other things became unraveled. So that really is, I think, not an answer for this year, but I think we can do some good work and get answers that will really be invested in the long term.
So concerning the first recommendation of determining need, any other discussions?
I have a question which I think would be much easier than the last one. This is a question quick for me. That is that the factors that are looked at to determine the number of current judges.
Right.
No.
That's great. Right. I just want
right.
to make sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So
there was, I think there was somebody who was considering making a motion on A. So Sherry, did you approve A?
Yes. Judge?
John?
This is Linda, and Judge McKay from Merced. Just wanted to say that we're glad that the civil assessment is being deferred to next year because we're one of the Cluster 2 courts, but we also have a debt service that we've been paying on our new courthouse since 2007, and it doesn't expire until 2030. And so, you know, we use that money to pay the debt. So we're a little concerned, so I'm glad that that's being deferred. And I note that there's 13 other courts looking at our allocation that don't even collect civil assessments. There's large ones and small ones. So I understand that would benefit, you know, all the courts. But our concern is our debt service for our new building. So we're glad to see you put it here.
Okay. So I want to make sure I'm not cutting off any of the comments, Mr. Wright. There are people on the phone, but Sherry made a motion, Ms. Carter made a motion to approve recommendation A, determining need and the factors under it. Any further, first there needs to be a second.
Second.
Second from Mr. Yamasaki. So now it's been moved and approved that A, that A portion determining need. Any further discussion? All in favor of the determining need portion of the report to go to the council? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Any opposed? All right. No opposition. That was an aye.
Yes, got it.
That was an aye, not a no, right? I think it was Judge McCabe. Good.
Correct. Aye.
Okay. So next.
He's effectively using
it. Next, determining how we build the trial court allocations and the four factors there under that. One of the first things we discussed, and frankly, I think we came to a pretty quick and unanimous resolution on, was we're done with the historical base. For those that were even able to understand it, it appeared to make things overly complicated. And one of our goals, as I said when we started this meeting, was to simplify, again, with making sure that we have a good measurement. But we just thought the historical base was one that gave us trouble. Not that the original recommendation itself wasn't a valid recommendation, wasn't well thought, but after 5 years, it's run its course. So that was quickly resolved that we will move away from the historical base. And then playing that, number two, define new money. So you'll see as we move into the different scenarios that we're going to talk to in the next sections, one of those will address new money, one will address flat funding, and one will address, heaven forbid, lack of or cuts. But how would we define new money? And it's right in front of you. It says any new ongoing allocation of general discretionary dollars to support the cost of a trial court workload, excluding funding for benefits and retirement increases. So that was some wordsmithing. It was another one of those times in the room where we used the board. We crossed things out. Part of it, a little of it was grammar, but most of it was substance. And that's how we came up with a definition of new money. So, again, I'm doing all the talking here, but I was just one of numerous people in the room for FMS, so I'd invite any other comments as I move through these. The next factor was beginning in 18-19, the trial court beginning base allocations will be established using the prior year-ending base allocations. So that's how we look. That's how we'll look at each new year. Look back to the prior year and move forward. And then the graduating funding floors are being retained until such time as the Cluster 1 courts reach 100% of their funding needs, which we'll address when we talk about new money. But I don't want to forestall any discussions about that now. So I've set forth those four elements. Any FMS members in the room want to add anything or any questions about those four elements of building trial court allocations? Thoughts?
I'll move adoption.
Okay. It's been moved that we adopt the building trial court allocations as set forth in section B on page 24 of the report. Is there a second?
Second.
Second?
One through four
of B. So I should be clear. You're right. So A, 1 through 6 hasn't been approved. We're now moving to B, 1 through 4, and it's been moved and seconded that the building trial court allocations have set forth be approved. Any further discussion on the building trial court allocations aspect of the report? Concerns? All in favor? Aye?
Aye.
Any opposition?
Aye.
No opposition. Okay. So now we're going to move to what we found to be in the room one of the best ways to then say, well, how is this going to work? And we came up with scenarios. And the three possible scenarios that we felt were the most productive to use, what happens when there's hopefully new money, what happens when realistically there might not be any new money, and what happens when hopefully won't happen, and that is there's a cut.
And then also the non-discretionary fund is clumped in with the reduction.
Okay, right. So we can start at either one of those scenarios. The one that was, again, not We did not want to ignore it, but we felt that we simply could not address it until it happened, and that was the scenario where there's cuts. And it's that, and again, I invite comments from those who are in the room, but the concern there was we're dealing in a vacuum. We don't know. So there's really no way to deal with those cuts until they come about. I remind you, the work of the funding methodology is not done. It remains in existence, and that's what its purpose will be. As with the work of the council, and the council obviously is the ultimate authority to say, to tick back into other entities, appreciate the model, but consider this, or this is a new thing that's come up, and that builds in some flexibility that we'll talk about at the end of the day. But I guess the easiest, not the easiest, but the discussion we quickly were able to resolve was, we can't deal with a cut until it happens. Anybody in the room as far as FMS want to add to that, as far as the scenarios and how they'll be dealt with? Sherry?
Yeah, just to clarify, I think what we said was is that if there is a needed allocated reduction, we would address it the year it occurs because of the scenarios that could happen, because it might be in restricted money, it might be. So we would address any, what you call reductions or I call allocations, reduction allocations. We would do them in the year that they're imposed so that we can ebb and flow with, you know, the situation.
And Brandy just pointed out to me, and I think that exemplifies that, same with non-discretionary funds. If there's a reduction in those, we won't know. So probably.
Exactly.
Right, or exactly.
Yeah, that's, yeah, right. Yeah.
Yep. All right.
We're not going to know until the governor's budget's approved. Have to respond very, very quickly.
Right.
And we can, I mean, we're pretty nimble, but I understand I don't mean to speak for all the trial courts. I know that's a problem, and we tried to build as best we could predictability into the model, but we can't predict that, and therefore we felt it was both impossible to deal with. But if that happens, this committee can get together very, very quickly and consider that. I mean, if there's an earthquake, a flood, or a fire, which two of three have just occurred in the past year at least, and it cuts the budget, then we deal with it. We're not being dismissive of it. I think we just recognize, as I think Sherry put it better than I did, we won't know until the year it happens, and then we deal with the allocation or the lack thereof. Okay, so then on the other side was what happens when there's new money.
Well, do you need a motion to address the reduction? Do you want to make that separate from the new money, no new money?
But it is 7 and 8.
The thought is to perhaps take these all together, but they play together.
All right.
So, again, the three scenarios of no new money, new money, and then flat funding. But again, I'm, as the chair, it's my responsibility to run the meeting, but not to dictate the meeting. So if there's discussions or thoughts, please share them. So now the other side of this is the scenario we've dealt with, and the scenarios are set out. What page are they on? 58. There's a very nice scenario portion of this report that sets these out that we can talk about once we go through all three of these potentials. But, pardon me? 82. But the other one is, so what happens, hopefully, when there is new money? And how is that new money allocated? And so, in the new money years, and I think this exemplifies how concerned we were about the perception of do no harm and the perception of courts that are continuing to feel pain, recognizing we all are. So we came up with the following scenario or methodology for new money. And the first would be of whatever amount you want to call that new money. We talked about $100 million, one, probably to plant a seed and to be hopeful, but just because 100 is easy to talk about and percentages. So the first thing that would happen with that $100 million is it would go to bringing the Cluster 1 courts up to 100% of their funding need. That's a relatively small amount of money, believe it or not. It's less than a few million dollars.
It's 4.2, 4.6.
Approximately $3 million of the total allotment. So it was a relatively small amount of money. Now, there was discussion in the room, and Judge Cope, I'm not sure if he's still on the line or if he's trying to get case management systems still breathing, but there was a perception, hold on a minute here. Why are, if we're talking about funding all courts at a, essentially a 75%, or that's a floating number, but it moves slightly within that range, how do we explain to court that with some of them are at 100%? I'm not a small court, but the sentiment in the room was it's a whole different universe for the small courts, and an economy of scale was what was discussed throughout. And that economy of scale cannot be measured the way it is for other courts. And so we felt it was most appropriate to say to those courts, we're going to give you that relief and just give you 100% of your need. If new money comes in, that's the first thing that's going to happen. And candidly, it's going to make things a lot easier because it's going to remove that aspect of the measurement, and the new court, the small, those courts are going to have what they need, and hopefully they're happy, and that discussion is no longer one that is of concern. Any thoughts from FMS folks who are in the room about the
I think we redefine small courts as including four judge courts, please.
It is what it is. Go ahead.
And I think that comment goes to the heart of the earlier discussion where we said, look, we need to look at those cluster two issues, and the fours may be closer to ones, in which case we may want to take that position.
Right.
And so I wouldn't say no. It may not be. It may be appropriate.
Right.
It's
and,
not
and,
there yet.
And so what? And what we'll talk about as we go on is what our goal was, not to jump too far ahead of time, but is to come up with a funding methodology, do our best to predict how it's going to work, but recognize we won't know how it's going to work until it happens. And so if that plays out, if we get new money and we're able to do that, and then we can step back and say, now what about cluster two? So part of this is a wait-and-see approach, but trying as best we can to come up with an effective method to wait and see. Does that answer your concern?
It does, and I'm not being critical. I'm just
sure. No, that's
we're all dealing with people who want to hear.
Yep. Sure. Okay. So then the next hopeful aspect was okay. So now we've addressed those cluster one courts. What do we do now? So whatever chunk of money that is out of the $100 million, that's gone. So let's just talk. I'm just going to do this because my brain is very simple as far as math goes. Let's assume it's $100 million, and that takes $10 million out of the pot. So now we're at $90 million. Okay? We now allocate up to 50% of that remaining funding to the courts that are under the statewide average band based upon WAPA. That band will change every year because that band, remember, is measured on a three-year moving average. So that band shifts, and then the next 50% of the remaining new funds goes to those courts that are under the band. The allocated funds will bring the courts up, but not over the statewide average. So the hope is those, again, recognizing we're all in need, but those courts that are most involuntarily needful will come up into the sweet spot, the average range. And once they're there, they're there. And they no longer will be considered to be an involuntarily needful court, recognizing that they don't have everything they need, but they've been addressed. And that amount of money also is nowhere near as small as it was for the cluster ones, but it's hopeful that the first amount of funding brings them up. And once they're up there, assuming as the band moves, they remain there, they're there. So that's where the next amount of the next 50% of the new money goes, to bring those courts up into the sweet spot. I've, again, done all the talking here, but if I want questions, and anybody on the funding methodology wants to add to that to make sure it's stated accurately.
Rebecca, any thoughts?
No, you're fine.
Yeah, I do have a question, and it concerns the no new money scenario. And
but we're not there yet.
Okay, so
I don't mean to
skip over that.
Pardon me?
So we skipped over that.
No, well, we did. I'm going backwards. Okay. I'm sorry, just because I thought it was easier to talk. The easiest, and I was trying to share the perspective in the room. Our discussion that was the one that took the least amount of time was what happens if there's cuts. The next one was, though it took some time, the new money.
Okay.
And then obviously the challenging one, the most challenging of the three was no new money. So I'm not want to be dismissive of your concern, but that's just thing. So that was our new money recommendation. Now we get to, okay. Oh, I'm sorry, C&D. Then, so now we've made the cluster one courts, we've addressed them, 50% of the remaining goes to those courts that are involuntarily needful, and then the remaining 50% goes to everybody. So this is where we did have discussion, and we did try to address in what's happened to those courts in good years that have said, hold on a minute here, you're giving and then you're taking away because you're reallocating. And this money would address that, and it would say in new money years, you are going to get new money, and you're not going to have to worry about that reallocation because you're going to get the new money. Because if you look at it, we've already taken care of the Cluster 1 courts. We've done our best to address the need of those courts that are involuntarily needful, and so now everybody else, all 58, you get the next 50%. It's allocated to you based upon workload. It comes to you. You don't have to worry about we're handing it to you, and then we're taking it back to address those courts that are under, because we've already tried to address those courts that are under. But that's where the new money then goes. And no court's allocation can exceed 100% of its need unless it's a result of a funding floor calculation. So no court, and that'll be the day. It's like, if that's the problem we have, that those courts that are other than funding floor courts are getting 100% of the need, I don't need to say anything more. So those are the aspects of new money. That was a discussion in the room. There were a lot of machinations there, but that's what we came to. We felt was the way to address all those concerns. And then, no new money. What do we do? And I stepped back as I did in a lot of these discussions. This no new money. So I'm just gonna state my bias. I thought this was one of the most effective ways to deal with no new money that was developed in the room, and I had nothing to do. There are other voices in the room that said, what about this? And this came about. And I think, and again, I'm stating my bias, like I'm a Dodger fan. I think this is, but I'm by stating my bias, I don't mean to say I'm trying to prevent anybody else from stating a concern. But, so what happens when there's no new money? We have the band, and that band is 2% above and 2% below the moving statewide average that's calculated every year. So if you're 2% above or 2% below, now, let's just assume for the sake of math only, that the statewide average is 75%. Yes, what that means is there's going to be some courts at 73% and some courts at 77%. There's going to be a little bit of a difference there. But what we talked about, 3% and 1% and 4%, and we felt that was, one, what we could best deal with, and two, a compromise, frankly, to say, if you're 2% above or 2% below, we did our best. And yes, maybe the 73% courts are looking at the 77% courts and saying, we wish we were there, but we felt it was bringing everybody pretty close. Sherry?
And I think another primary reason that the band is good is because of the concerns about predictability and stability. If adjustments are being made based on workload, because the workload would be calculated every year, and there are workload fluctuations, there wouldn't be adjustments as long as your workload falls within that 4%. So I think that there was a recognition that when we're committed to a workload-based allocation, and that workload is going to fluctuate from year to year, we don't want to give one year and take the next because of minor adjustments in the workload. So this band helps to create the stability that some of the courts had concerns about, where one year I gain and one year I lose, because workload will continue to fluctuate in all of our counties. So I wanted to point that out.
And I'm very glad you made that point. So when you're within the band, you're protected. When you're within that 2% above, 2% below, you're protected.
I think it's also important for the non-members of the subcommittee to understand we looked at narrower bands and broader bands. And at the end of the day, the 2% seemed to be that sweet spot that would minimize what I've called micro adjustments from year to year, based on those types of fluctuations.
Getting back to the predictability, stability rationale that we continue to apply. Mike, the other Mike?
So this, the fluctuation in workload really kind of came home for me as that last week as I was reading through the 2017 Core Statistics Report, reports on all statistics. And if I recall the cover memo, statewide filings dropped 9% over the year, but mostly in the lower weighted case categories, as I understand. But I went and looked at our numbers. Our filings went down 1%. So there's an example of how someone's down 9%, someone's down 0%. And that's been, and so I thought that made it real for me in terms of how we look at the band and how that addresses kind of the issue the Sherry was raising, that fluctuation. So, you know, tomorrow if you're not doing anything, go look at the CSR and see how you stand compared to the statewide average. Let me give you a sense. So I just want to point out just a real example of this in play.
So now we continued in the scenario of no new money to say, what about the involuntarily generous and the involuntarily needful, the donor and recipients that we're staying away from? Yes.
Just throw something out. Because I think every time you say it, I can tell you heads up a little bit. Can't we just say courts that are above the average?
Sure.
And courts that are below the average?
Above and below. That's fine. That's easier for me to say, too. It's less words. Above. But when you say the average, you mean above the band.
Funding level.
Right.
The average funding level within the band.
Yep. Average funding level within the band. So.
Because when you say above the average, it's just the average. It's clearly well below where they should be funding.
Exactly right. Yep. Thank you. I appreciate that comment. So now what's the scenario that happens in year one of no new money? And as it's set forth, funds will be allocated from courts above the band and below the band every other fiscal year to a maximum of 1%. So in the first year, there's no reallocation of no new money. In the first year of no new money, there's no reallocation. And we did that to address, we did our best to address those courts that were saying below or above the average, how it impacted them. The first year of no new money, there is no reallocation. So now this is where the scenarios really come into play. So let's go through the scenario. What happens in year number two? So now there's year number two of no new money. And there is. And I will summarize my perspective of what I thought was the compromise in the room after more than a spirited discussion, and that was we have to continue to take steps for those courts that are below the average or below the band. We can't say to them in the vernacular, suck it up. I'm sorry, we're not going to do anything anymore. Because as Lotko has described appropriately many times, the pie is the pie, and we have to work within that exact amount of money. So you can't say to the courts that are above the band, you can't say to the courts below the band, well, we're going to adjust you, unless at the same time you say to the courts that are above the band, we're going to adjust you, because the money's got to come from somewhere. But we also then said, well, hold on a minute. In years past, some of those courts that are above the average have really been asked to reallocate a substantial amount. So we came up with, again, different scenarios, 1%. First year, no new funding, nothing happens as far as a reallocation. Second year, if it is a second year, in that scenario, year two is no new funding, then the reallocation is a maximum of 1%. So there will be predictability. You will, yes, in that second, if we have a second year, yes, there will be some ask of you, but it will be no more than 1%. And that, Sherry, go ahead. Did you have a concern or comment?
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to help explain some of the rationale when you're at that point.
So that's what it is. It's in second year, 1%. But same to the courts that are under the average. It's in the second year of flat funding, of no new funding, the most we can do for you is 1%. The math works. Sherry?
So the rationale around that were the concerns that came from all of the numerous letters that were submitted that talked about kind of a lack of predictability and a lack of stability and not having advance notice of what the reductions would be or what the gains would be. And so by doing it this way, if we do the workload adjustments every year and publish them, if your court is seeing that their workload is going down compared to the average, now you have a year make the adjustments that you need to make because you know that you're going down. And so it's kind of putting you on notice. And if you're a court that's gaining, then it also puts you on notice that, you know, you will be receiving money as well. So it gives you a year to make the adjustments. The 1% is helping then also with predictability because if you're going down or going up, you now know that it's not going to be more than this 1% of the during that year. So rather than these huge swings, like I know Mike talked about as a member of the funding methodology committee, it would be more manageable because you'd have a year to adjust, and you would know more what the amount was rather than these huge amounts that were very difficult to adjust to. And on the flip side, it gives the courts that are growing an opportunity to strategically identify where they're going to hire staff and where their workload needs are and things like that.
Mike, this was clearly a compromise. Because, you know, in this context, we did discuss what's been referred to as the hold harmless provision, where in years where there was no money, there would be no reductions whatsoever. And I think the general sentiment of the committee, as reflected in the compromise, is that the risk of that would be that, you know, if there were a number of years of no new money, we would essentially make no continuing progress towards reaching that equity point within WAFM. And so for those who've been cut, you know, are concerned about cuts every single year, at least the fact that there's an every other year pause, assuming multiple years of no new money, was, I think, the place we were going to get. I think there was a recognition from other committee members that continuing year after year after year in a no-new-money scenario to face reductions was probably not a wise thing to do either. And just to make sure that we're clear about what we talk about in terms of a pause year, you know, in a scenario we talked about, and let's say in 18-19 we get no-new-money, there would be no adjustment because that's the first year. Well, let's say that we go 2 or 3 years and get money. But in 2022, we again face no new money. Even though there's been a period of time in between, it would be the second year of no new money. So we're going to have to keep track longitudinally of how things happen. And it's not back-to-back. It's not simultaneous or contemporaneously. It's at any point along the spectrum where you have the second year of no new money, which could be 4 or 5 years in the future, you would then face that 1% reduction scenario. So at the end of the day, I think I did vote for the compromise as a court that's been affected by years of no new money and reductions. I think that's where the committee was going
to
go.
Yeah, and so there was an outcome. It's hard to describe the atmosphere in the room when that compromise was discussed, but I think it was a significant point. Because you had the courts, as Mike is saying, that were above the average, perceptually, and those below, saying, you got to help us, and those above saying, you can't hurt us. And there was one of those courts in the room that was above and one that was below, and they both looked at each other and said, I can live with that. And I think that's almost the quote. I can live with that. But to follow up on the scenario, to make sure everybody understands it, so what happens? Year one, no new money. Consecutive year two, no new money, then it's the 1% at the most. Third year, no new money. Well, then we start over. But as Mike just said, that's another year. That third year is now a start over point. So there would not be two consecutive years of a cut.
In a no new money scenario.
In a no new money scenario. But as Mike said, I want to be careful of the fingers I point out, but if you have no new money, new money, new money, and in the fourth year, that's the second year of no new money, then there would be the adjustment. But the fifth year, you start over again. So there would never be two consecutive years of a reallocation if there's two consecutive no new money years. And we felt that was actually a very effective and fair compromise to the court's stated concerns. So the scenarios, as I said, those scenarios, I think, really help you understand how this plays out. Mike, and then I wasn't sure if Sherry had her hand up.
And again, at the heart of the issue is, I think, the feeling that we want to continue to make progress towards the goal. And this continues that progress, albeit with potential for pause years. But, again, it was clearly a compromise, probably the way things should be done on many levels in government. But I think the committee really argued this one over more than any other issue, except maybe the BLS issue. At the end of the day, again, it was something that I supported on the subcommittee.
Sherry, did you have a comment? I'll just try your hand.
No,
okay.
No. I think that this was a really good way to provide stability, predictability, It gives us, we need to do the workload, make sure the numbers get out, and capping it at 1% and not having 2 years of reduction in a row is a good compromise.
And I was just going to go over what you did explain, Judge, that reset after the second year, no matter how far down the road that goes, and you won't even need a year of reductions that could end up consecutive years of reduction, but only the reduction environment and a no stability environment.
And I'm glad you brought up that point. And keep in mind, as ongoing, the hope was as if new money comes in those intervening years, that brings more courts in the band, and then they're immune from the 1% adjustment. So the hope is that, and the message we hope to deliver, because, again, keep in mind, we've never lost the message that we are only at 75% of our need. There is a significant amount of money out there that we need, we're not getting. But that was a discussion for a different day. But one of the things we recognized by this model was once you come into that band, then there's fewer courts below and fewer courts above. So in another year of no new money, it gets, and hopefully we everybody comes within the band. And we're all within that band that will move every year based upon the statewide average. If you're within the band, we don't have to talk about adjustments because you're within the band.
Add that. This is Rebecca. I put it on the phone. I would just add that coming back to predictability, this also speaks to it being a little bit simpler to follow. You know, we've had this five-year approach, and, you know, if you were able to, you know, follow the columns of the spreadsheet, maybe you understood how you got the final column. But with the predictability of this method, you know, as we leave and people come in and, you know, et cetera, it's something that we can explain very easily as to the approach and the formula behind it. And so it will be more understandable as people get used to that.
David?
Yeah, so thank you very much, Judge. I had the opportunity to provide written comment to FMS as well as provide verbal comment during the open comment period in advance of the meetings that were held. And I was also able to hear where the conversation started in terms of what it is that we wanted to accomplish to help equity among the branches or among the different courts, and where the FMS subcommittee ended up in this accomplishment. I know that my initial comments really focused on the whole harmless issue and certainly being from Orange and not having had any increases over a number of years has been very challenging. But I also recognize that courts that have been well below the average have been challenged for perhaps even longer than courts that are above the average have been experiencing. And while
I've been asked, somebody knows, ask you to keep your voice up because they like your comments, but they want to hear all.
So while my initial proposal or objective was to try to get this hold harmless going forward, I think that the enormous work, the conversations that took place, the level of analysis that was done by this subcommittee, and the outcome recognized the impact on everybody. And while it is not perfect, it's outstanding in my view, and I fully support this proposal, notwithstanding my earlier comments. I think it's the right thing to do. It keeps us moving forward and furthers the objective of the Talk Board Budget Advisory Committee when they embarked on this exercise of improving equity among the courts. And even when there isn't new funding, there is going to be continued progress along the way. So where we started and where we ended up are in two different places, and I think this particular place that we're going to be considering today is exactly the way we should operate as a branch. Together, recognizing the needs of all, but also not getting too far ahead by moving forward with adjustments that are this, and if you would entertain a motion, I would be happy to make it.
Okay. Before then, I appreciate that, so I'll turn to you first when we get there. But Kim wanted to make a comment, and then Chad. Kim?
I just wanted for clarification on the the up to 1% allocation. That truly is an up to number. For example, if the courts below that band, bringing them up a max of 1% is $10 million, but the courts above that band, bringing them down 1% is $20 million, it would be a pro rata share for those above, correct? And vice versa. If it costs $20 million to bring them up, but only $10 million results from the decrease, same thing will occur, correct?
Yep. And it's a maximum of 1% to get them in the band. If they need less than 1% to get them in the band, then they're in the band.
Correct.
Right. Chad?
I think that Alameda's opposition on the what to do in the no new money, I mean, our PJ, our incoming PJ, stated it multiple times. I don't think I need to sort of restate it here. What I did want to just sort of throw in, I guess, or I mean, it might be a question for staff, I'm not sure, but one thing that we have heard in our discussions with the other branches of government, when I say we, I mean our core, is that, one, they find this model where we're cutting some courts to add to others. I guess I'll use the word confusing. And what we've heard is that's not generally how it's done in other sectors of government. Usually it is a hold harmless and you bring others up. We've also heard that it sends a mixed message in the sense that we're out there saying we need more money, and yet we're also saying that some courts can afford to give to others. So, you know, I just want to make sure that that has been considered. I don't know what message this sends to the other branches if we keep doing it this way, as opposed to how they do it in education, for example. You know,
I appreciate that. I think we have to be careful who delivers the message. We have to be careful that the person, the entities delivering the message, are the ones that have the most information to deliver. I agree that for those outside of the branch, this may, at a C-level perspective, be confusing, but I think as you look at it, and I think as this discussion demonstrates today, it's not. It fundamentally is one that has a basis of fairness and of predictability and stability. So you're right, Chad, I agree with you. I think there is some confusion in the other branches. I think part of that is self-imposed, and that's a lack of education. Part of it is different messages that they may be receiving and how those messages may be inconsistent, and therefore the importance of the message being delivered from an appropriate voice. But I agree with you that there have been problems with that in the past. That was a discussion in the room. And this methodology, I saw another hand.
That was a major consideration when we started to look at that. How can we present this in such a way that can be readily explained? For example, if John Wardlaw or Zlatko are going to the Department of Finance and presenting this, is this a way that can be shown? And in another way of looking at it, it is a continued shared sacrifice, because if you are in a position where you still may be 10% below to get you to the band, in those new money years, you're only moving up a slight percentage, and there is still a sacrifice from those who are having to have an allocation taken away. But the consideration of how this would be presented was very important to the subcommittee, so that somebody can say, this is where we're moving. We're trying to stay within this percentage.
Rebecca, Jim.
And I would just say that simplification and the understandability of the method was a major discussion all throughout, from day one until the day we left. And in fact, so much so that we built it into principles guiding the methodology going forward. And each time, and you know, the members will attest to this, every time I stopped everybody and I said, okay, are we still adhering to the objectives and to the principles we've set? And so we believe that once we have this rolled out, without that historical recalculation and without the unknown for six, or without the all these different pieces that the first iteration had, we feel like it will be a simplified method, which in and of itself may reduce
volatility that is around that, that angst of not knowing where you're going and creating that
I would say, first of all, the compromise and the wisdom in the subcommittee is it starts, I think, really with six. That is, what I think it would be very frustrating for courts and I'm very, very confusing to legislators is that money was given, yet some courts were cut. And what's good about this overall program is that even if it's $20 million, as it was a couple of years ago, there will be some money given. The only way there could be a reduction is when there's no money. And it, to me, it's very simple. But if the pie's not getting bigger, and we're going to give someone a little bit more, someone has to go down. I think the legislators will understand this much better. And it makes more sense that when they do give us money, every court, including quote-unquote their court, will get some kind of an increase.
And I guess, I don't know if you got, and sorry for those on the phone, I'm addressing it to staff, but are there other zero-sum game models like this in government where when you're doing a funding reallocation amongst entities where this is the way it's done, right, where you, instead of the whole harmless that we've asked for and bring everybody up. So to your point, Judge Buckley, you know, I think our proposal would be hold harmless in the no new money, and then instead of 50-50 when there's new money, make it 75-20. I mean, like really flood the new resources to the people below the line, not at 50-50.
But
I just don't know what, you know, again, I know what I've been able to find on my own. I know anecdotally what I've been told. You guys both have been in the executive branch longer. So are there other models like the one being proposed or like the one we've had in the last 5 years where you're sort of changing the slices of the pie every year?
A couple things. Mike's going to make a comment. I didn't mean to cut you off of Mike and Hannah, but I just want to address one thing about the whole harmless. There was significant discussion in the room in no new money years, zero-sum dollars, about how it is practical or possible to hold harmless, depending on your perspective. Because if you have a no new money year, for those courts, to quote Judge Buckley's standard, that are above average, stay above average. And of those courts that are below average, stay below average, there is harm. You are not holding harmless. Because the courts that continue to be below the average stay above the average and get no relief. So the perspective in the room was, and the significant discussion in the room about the hold harmless concept was, let's try that as best we can. But in a zero-sum year, to say to those courts that are below average, and again, Chad, I'm overstating it, but sometimes overstating it, if we have 10 years of no new money, you're going to live there for 10 years. You're going to live below average for 10 years. And those courts that are above average are going to live above average for 10 years, recognizing that nobody's where they need to be. The discussion was, that's not appropriate. But that was my perception in the room. If anybody has a different perception, please share it. And Mike, I cut you off. Okay. So that was how we turned. Now, I don't know the answer to the, and I'll leave it to the those that have much more wisdom and knowledge about if there's other analogous government entities that were distributed the same way, and Mike now has his hand back.
It seems to me that we are in some ways late to the game, because if you go back, and I don't pretend to be an expert, but if you go back and look at school funding in the post-Prop 13 era, there were tremendous differences between districts based on their property tax, and a lot of those things were dealt with 40 years ago. So nobody knows about, you know, any other areas, because all the people that did that are gone. Well, here we are in the 21st century now having to grapple with the same things that school districts and others were probably grappling with 40 years ago, because we weren't really a branch of government 40 years ago, and now we are. So, I mean, if you go back and look at some of those post-Prop 13 adjustments at county levels and at city levels and at special district levels, they went through a lot of this upheaval. They may not have done it the same way. But unless we're committed to kind of not making progress towards equity, the whole, if we're going to stop that progress, then the whole harmless works. But I didn't detect, and I don't detect support from the commission or the committee that we really want to just stop, that we want to in some way continue to make progress, even in those bad years where there's no new money. So it's a compromise.
Any addition for the question about other government entities that are analogous that would have?
I agree with Mr. Roddy that, you know, if you look at realignment Prop 98, that the basic structure of funding, you know, school districts, for example, it's a very, very complicated methodology that's used for how school districts get funded, at how lower level and higher level education. Very complicated. I'm not aware of any workload-based entity that does not have a fairly sophisticated method for which they allocate funds out. And so to answer your question on are there other parallel systems out there? My answer would be yes, and they are very complicated, and it would take a lot of time and effort for us to give you an answer on the various pieces of workload within these different areas, how that works. I think if you looked at the counties, for example, the county methodology, school districts, all are very complex and not easy as far as the simple answer for you.
Tanya?
To just sort of address that issue that you're talking about, Chad, our primary or number one on our objective list is to reach equity of available funding based on workload. And that was a principle that we agreed to early on. And in order for us to achieve that, like Mike said, we have to continue, you know, we've agreed we're going to march forward that direction. This is the way that we can hold as harmless as we can do and still make the progress we need to get to this objective of equitable allocation within the monies and the resources we have. Because it's all we have.
So actually John says it better, but I'm just gonna prompt him a little bit. So if we were the prison system and it was based on workload, they do readjust. If one prison had fewer inmates, they would lose money, and those that had more inmates would gain money on those situations. So there are, within the department, those kind of workloads. So if we get to a true workload and get enough money for our system, we'll be able to make those changes. And what we've put in place are safeguards so that there's not too much fluctuation. But John said it's better, way better than he had a number of times. But there is that the state does make adjustments based on workload. And if it was easy, we'd be able to present a very easy model.
Absolutely. If that wasn't clear, education is by pupil. Okay, it's a complicated formula, but yes, the bottom line is based on pupil. If you look at the social services programs, it's a caseload. If you look at the prison population, it's POP that is going up and down. And that's the basic premise. And I would argue that for this branch, there should be some consideration on true funding based on silos. That's not the model that we have right now. We have a base allocation that the legislature appropriates, and that doesn't have a very clear tie directly to the increases and decreases within our filing. We're just not, at this point, with the legislature, that's not the model that they've embraced for funding for our branch.
I'm sorry, Judge Barton, and then, okay.
I was just going to indicate that I recognize the compromise coming from an above-the-band court, I guess is the new terminology. But what I think it does is enables us to convey a message to the executive and legislative branches that we are behind WAFM, that it works, that it is a good and accurate measure of workload, and you need to fund it to the extent that the workload is reflected in that model. And the secondary message is that to the extent we're reshuffling revenue within the model, we're helping those most in need. And so I think if we as a branch can get to the point where we speak with one mind on this subject, we can take the argument away from the legislature and the executive, which is they don't have their act together, so let's not fund them this year. I don't think that this will necessarily carry the day and get us to a point where we'll actually get more money, but at least we perhaps if we message this right, we can take an argument away and really put them to the task of whether they will step up or not.
Margins?
Yes. Just want to make a comment. My earlier question that I didn't pose actually has turned into a comment. My concern was that the single sentence which explains why you have alternate lag years of no adjustments and adjustments just did not satisfy me. It said
where
it'll provide.
Where you're looking?
I'm looking at 5C,
okay.
Where the rationale is it'll provide time to adjust for a second year. To me, it didn't wasn't a more of a selling point than simply making adjustments every year of flat funding. But thanks to the comments of Sherry and Mike Roddy and yourself, Jessica Conklin, I'm satisfied. It does make sense.
Appreciate that. Okay, so it's a quarter of 12. I'm stating the obvious by the clock on the wall. I've tried my best to work through now the conclusion of item 2 in the report, no new money. I want to make sure we talked about everything. The adjustments, and how they would be impacted. The committee reserves the right to return to the Judicial Council to propose changes to the model as needed. So, part of the discussion here was clarifying that there was some uncertainty as to what WAFM, how long was intended to last. And this is a discussion that's long past, but it was a discussion about, is it a five-year model? Is it a five-year pause model? Is it a model that just keeps going and at 5 years it's reevaluated? And that's not for this. That's not what this recommendation is about. This recommendation is about proposing to the council a methodology that can be relied upon or the trial court will be used until any adjustment is recommended from the council or from the other perspective from the funding methodology subcommittee. So it is a set model, so to speak, as set as anything can be, because the council obviously has the ultimate authority to turn back to TICBAC or JBBC or whoever they intend to point their questions to and say, here's the model you gave us. We've had it for a year or two. Here's some concerns we have, or here's some perspectives that we now have developed. What do you think? Or from the other side, the funding methodology subcommittee that will continue to monitor this to say, we didn't anticipate this. Or maybe, guess what? This is, as an update, this is working real well. So there will be some flexibility concerning adjustments, but those adjustments will not be built in until it's determined what needs to be adjusted. Rebecca?
And so just to that point, we'll continue to have a work plan that will result in some kind of a recommendation back to the committee, as well as an annual process to receive suggestions from the branch. And so as we flesh those out and we fine-tune this and become more sophisticated with the model, there will be resulting recommendations back to the committee, which may subsequently be recommended to the council as adjustments to the methodology.
And as I think with anything, that the staff would have the ability to make technical adjustments as it moves out. That's as set forth in C2. But Mike, did you have a comment?
I'm prepared to make a recommendation or a motion. Chair is ready to entertain that.
I am, but I just want to make sure we've had plenty of time to discuss. Six being new money?
Yes, six being new money. So A, cluster one first come up to at least 100%.
At the most 100%.
At least.
Okay.
In the event
okay, fine. Right.
And then C, they get more. But D, they get more than 100%.
They wouldn't get any if they're at 100%.
Right.
If they're already at 100%, no one can go above 100% except for the courts that are floor courts, and I think there's just two.
We had those are way down in the weeds. Also, that people did say, what about this, what about that? And I think Sherry brought up the point, or somebody brought up the point, what about that small number of courts, and that addresses that. So you're right. We intended it to be stated that way. Even though it may appear to be internally inconsistent, it is consistent.
That's my great comment.
Probably my fault.
Shouldn't that be B5?
It should. So, B. P is B.
Congratulations.
Welcome to the committee.
That's a pretty good reward.
So E is the size of the identified band, and B, 5A, will be subject to reevaluation, and Judge Lucas has just nominated herself to be on every subcommittee. All right. So there's been an invitation for a motion to approve, so there's a couple options. One, lunch is here. If you folks want to take a few minutes and contemplate this before you vote, I don't want to be in any way making it look like I cut off discussion. People don't have enough time to think about it. But if you've had enough time to think about it and you're ready to vote, Mr. Ryder, are you making that motion?
I would move that we approve B5, B6, B7, and B8, as well as C1 and 2, as recommended in the report.
A and B already being approved. All right?
And I'll second that.
So it's been essentially now moved that the remainder of the recommendations be approved, with the typographical error being corrected. Any further discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Judge Conklin, I did the chat. I would vote aye on everything except no as to B5. If I can vote in that way.
Well, okay. Yes, you can, but then that, so let's just then be careful.
Sorry.
That's okay. So now we'll just break them up. So let me go in reverse order. Any opposition to B, let me just take it, B6, B7, or B8? All in favor of B6, B7, and B8? And C. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And now breaking out separately, B5. All in favor of B5? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. One nay. All right. So each of those is approved unanimously. 6, 7, except 5 is a single nay. With that, you've earned lunch. Lunch is here. We're well within our schedule, so everybody okay with a half an hour for lunch? And we'll, for those of you that are on the phone, we'll reconvene in 30 minutes at 12:20. Thank you. We're off the record.
All right. So we're thank you for your patience for those folks calling in to listen. We're just about to get started. We have one more item on our agenda, and both due to fatigue and taking over too much of the agenda, I'm going to turn this to Rebecca. Item three, the Funding Methodology Subcommittee Work Plan. This was another significant part of our discussions. As I said, I sort of framed the issue of where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. So this is that. Rebecca?
So the work plan, as we started framing out the structure for the process to go through and create the methodology, not only were we revisiting objectives and principles, but we revisited the work plan and what the original list looked like, and it grew and grew and grew, and it never seemed like anything fell off. And so as we started identifying all the pros and cons and objectives that we had going forward, we also incorporated in the work plan. And so the resulting document is on page 96, and you will find that there's a couple of things that transferred over, and we decided to address them in later years. We said there were certain things that were annual updates that we wanted to hear about every year just to stay informed. And then there were things that dropped off as we incorporated them into the process. And so what you'll find is the new work plan, and there are existing work plans on page 95 if you want to compare line for line. But basically the resulting work plan is on page 96. For the remainder of 17-18, approving this methodology and rolling it out was what was listed for 17-18. 18-19 maintains the new judgeship staffing complement funding if necessary. The civil assessments and how it relates to WACM. Reviewing the trial court trust fund and IMF self-help funding allocation, which, I don't know if that'll intersect at all with the AB 1058 or not, but in any case, that'll continue to go forward. Identifying all funding sources and determine allocation models. And so that's really kind of a tangent off of civil assessments. There are other much smaller dollar amount items that are in there, but what we said is let's review everything that's on there and make sure if there's an allocation model that needs to be identified, we do that. Evaluate special circumstance case funding. Evaluate the impact of JCC and other provided services. That's an original item that came off of the parking lot list. And evaluate Cluster 2, BLS, and small court adjustment contributions. So that's on the list for next. Those are all on the list for next year. Yes.
Can you say what two of those?
So new judgeship staffing complement funding. There was a discussion early on, I think it actually was 16, 17, that said, let's talk about the funding that comes with new judgeship and whether or not that should be distributed differently or is it already counted in WACM? There was a big conversation about that. And
yes. Is that in connection with the reallocation?
Yes. That's what prompted. It was on a list, but it really prompted the conversation at that point. However, there was a further discussion that identified that the structure of the complement as it's proposed back to the legislature when we're putting in for those judgeships is very different than what we do. And so the conversation about the reallocation was had separately, and this was tabled. And we decided as a committee to table this whole subject until a later date because new judgeship funding was really what we were talking about. Reallocation funding we dealt with as that specific item. So new judgeships then coming in, their staffing is already addressed through WACM, but how do we reconcile that with what's actually given to the legislature because what we're submitting is actually something different. So there's a whole reconciliation process. I think I've just confused. I've been very confused.
Would you like me to try it from a very simplistic way? Previously, when the branch requested a new judgeship, they also asked for $80,000. I'm making it up. X dollars. Because the thought was that X dollars would go with the judge for the JA, intake staff, you know, whatever was related. That was before WACM. Now, WACM is based on workload for the staff side. The question is,
how do we merge those two together? That's the question.
Yeah. That's my
question. Does it still follow the new judge, or does it go into the pot or not? That's the discussion. Did I do that right?
That was great.
Okay.
Okay, so then moving on to 1920, we would look at how to include unfunded costs such as construction or like courthouse construction type of costs. Obviously, this work plan will change as we identify new things and as we identify potential weak areas in the methodology, but this is what we're asking you to approve going forward for the next year.
Comments, questions, concerns about the proposed item three, the funding methodology subcommittee work plan for the next year? Yes.
The only question I have is that we have a subcommittee that is working on 1058. So does number four, is that kind of duplicating their efforts?
So the number 12 is monitoring the output from that committee. And right now, it's limited to facilitator and to commissioner programs. But I do think that there's going to be at some point where this is going to intersect. So we're watching that closely. At the point where we get there and it hasn't intersected, we'll address it. And then we'll go from there.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions about the work plan, comments, or a motion to approve?
Mike? I'll move approval of the work plan.
Okay. Second. Moved and seconded that the Funding Methodology Subcommittee work plan be approved. Any additional comments, questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No opposition. Okay. So, it's now 12:30. This is one of those unknowns when we schedule these meetings. Obviously, we wanted to schedule 4 hours for this, recognizing the content, the importance of that content. Those listening in, I don't think should mistake the brevity of the motion for lack of concern. I'll invite now any additional comments or thoughts in general for the good of the order, anybody at all. I will, as I've commented before, and I don't mean to waste people's time, but I would like to thank every member of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee and every member of this committee. I'm constantly impressed by the work that goes into preparing for these meetings, both substantially and individually from the group, the staff as well. I sound like a broken record intentionally because the work that staff puts into this, you guys just don't know. I don't know how else to say it, but those listening in, I think the committee members know, but I do thank staff, every one of them, for putting together this report. Now what will happen is by unanimous vote, save one, for a minor sub-issue, this report will then be prepared and will be submitted to the Judicial Council at the January 12th meeting. So it will be posted appropriately. It has to work through levels of review and then get to the council. I'll appear in front of the council as the chair of TICBAC to present the report for a similar method or meeting as of today, questions, concerns, and then the council will tell us what's next, which is the way we started the meeting and the way I'd like to conclude it is to emphasize that this is a recommendation to the Judicial Council for their consideration, and it is not a stagnant methodology, I guess is the way to put it. This methodology is designed to create stability and predictability and recognize flexibility as a need. So, again, this gives the Council, as they have complete authority to come back to us and say, great model, but for this, and it gives FMS the ability to say, great model, but for this. And that's why I think this model will hopefully be an effective funding methodology. Not perfect, but I think George Heinrich said it, somebody at the end to quote, perfection at the expense of good, or however she said. So that's what it is. So before we adjourn and wish safe travel to everybody, any closing comments at all? Hearing none, thank you all very much for your time. We're off the record, we're off the recording.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.